From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made in January when a state assembly seat became vacant. We're talking about the 134th District, a seat that had been held by Republican Bill Reilich. He left the post to become supervisor of the town of Greece, and Governor Andrew Cuomo decided not to hold a special election, so the open seat will be filled by the winner of the election in November. And in this race, you have the somewhat unusual scenario of two former law enforcement officers. Republican Peter Lawrence was a state trooper and a U.S. Marshal. Democrat Gary Putup served in law enforcement for 30 years in four different departments, and both have had strong comments on a number of issues, the SAFE Act, gun rights, plenty of other hot-button state issues. As always, we're offering equal time here on Connections. My hope is that Peter Lawrence will be on this program soon. He has an open invitation here to join me for an hour between now and Election Day in November. Today, we welcome Gary Putup. Gary, thank you for being here.
Thanks, Evan. I'm happy to be here.
And let me also say to our listeners, the assembly can be a little esoteric, but these are issues we're going to talk about today that it does not matter where you live or what district you're in. These are big issues for voters and for citizens all across the state of New York. We're not going to spend the entire hour, unless listeners choose to stay there, Gary, on the SAFE Act and related issues, but you're retired law enforcement, and for much of the year, there's been a question about exactly how the SAFE Act would impact this election. So let me start there. What are you hearing from voters about it?
Well, Evan, what I'm hearing from voters is this, is that this is a small issue for a small number of people. And the reason we're hearing this is even polls tell us that when we deal with things like the membership of the NRA, the majority of the members of the NRA, especially in New York, agree with concepts such as having universal background checks. That when I talk to people and I mention to them, when we hear a politician say that he wants to repeal the SAFE Act, that we have to keep in mind what he is talking about is, or she, is repealing background checks. We're talking about repealing a police database that allows investigators to know who owns a handgun in New York and who does not. What we're talking about is repealing a section that would keep guns out of the hands of domestic violence abusers. We can talk, and I'm all ears. In fact, last week I went before SCOPE, which is the state affiliate of the NRA, which I've held from day one, that I'm open to any group, any people, any person. I'm happy to discuss any issue. And I will talk about amending the SAFE Act. In fact, I have a number of provisions that I would like to see amended in the SAFE Act. But if someone says that they want to repeal it, I cannot be in favor of repealing background checks on the purchases of firearms in the secondary market.
All right, but let me jump in there and say, on the subject of repeal, often the people I hear talking about repeal, it's similar to when we hear Obamacare and repeal. They say the whole is, again, this is what the repeal crowd says, the whole is a mess, scrap it, and then we can reinstitute the parts that we like. For example, in Obamacare, pre-existing conditions, okay, keep it. Insurance until you're X age under your parents, keep it. Similarly, in the SAFE Act, people are saying, on the whole, they don't like it, but they would keep maybe background checks. Maybe they would keep this part and that. So I don't know if it's fair to characterize the people who say repeal the SAFE Act as wanting to repeal every single part of it, is it?
Well, then we have to clarify what we're talking about, and language is important. We're talking about law. We're talking about how the law impacts society. Then we have to be very careful what we say. If a politician is telling people, I want to repeal it, without being specific, right, then I think he's just trying to pander to a group to get votes. If he says, I'm not going to repeal it, but I will amend it, then that's what he or she should say. The problem I have with that, and I ran into that last week, people will say, we're going to scrap the whole thing and then start from the beginning. All right, that's not what we're talking about with Obamacare. I haven't heard anybody since Obamacare has actually taken roots. And in states, red states like Kentucky, where people now love it. When we hear things about polling and people say, yeah, I hate Obamacare, but I love the Affordable Care Act.
Well, or they'll say, I don't like Obamacare, but then they're given a list of provisions in Obamacare and they say, oh, yes, I like this, I like this. Yeah. So it happens.
And if I may, Evan, the problem with that type of reasoning, especially in an issue like this, is that what do we do in the meantime? Now, we have to keep in mind this scenario was totally lawful prior to the enactment of the SAFE Act. I could go out and spend, and it's reasonable to think this. These are not exaggerations. I could easily go to a gun shop, buy an assault rifle, throw some of those extras on it, and spend between $1,500 and $2,000. I could go home, my wife could be upset that I spent that much money when we need a new roof on a house. You and I could be in a bar, I could be telling you, commiserating with you about how my wife is angry at me. A stranger walk up and say, geez, Gare, I'll buy that rifle. It's in the trunk of my car. We go out in the parking lot and we exchange money for the gun. And it's all lawful. We can't go back to those days. If you want to sit back again and talk about, let's amend it, sit down with me, sit down with other people in Albany and say, let's amend it. Here's the specific sections. And again, I have some specific sections that I would like to see amended. Let's do that. But again, to take away the tools that our DA, Sandra Dorley, has said that she needs to fight crime and illegal guns, to take away those tools from the police, to put our citizenry back in a situation where we're going to scrap background checks until we can figure out how to get them back again, that leaves a window that's just an opportunity for those that can't buy guns legally now to do that, and it would just cause more of a problem.
All right, so you're running for the assembly, and you are open to certain portions of reform. What specifically? Let's say that you're in charge of reforming the SAFE Act. What would you change?
The first thing I would change is there is a provision in the SAFE Act that talks about a $10 fee for transfer. Now, one of the things I did, again, you know, I live by the gun, so to speak. I mean, I use these in my work.
Let's go ahead real briefly. 30 years in law enforcement. The quick background is what?
Yep. And I still own guns. I still have a pistol permit. My wife has a pistol permit.
But what was your background in law enforcement?
I started with the state attorney general's office as a welfare fraud investigator, criminal welfare fraud investigator. I worked for the city police as a patrol officer, the Irondequoit police. Then I transferred and found a home in the Monroe County Sheriff's Office. I rose to the rank of lieutenant. I was a command officer, and I retired as the commander of the Internal Affairs Unit.
And as you said, even today, you own guns?
I do. Mm-hmm. I'm a shooter. I belong to two gun clubs. I enjoy the sport. I no problem with that.
Okay.
What
so
I do have problems with is unfettered access to guns. So some of the things that I specifically would change is there's a, and this comes from, again, my experience as a gun owner. And when this ad came out, I went and spoke to people, for instance, the owner of American Sportsman Gun Shop. I went to Jackson's Guns and Ammo. Actually, one of the owners there, one of the workers there, is a man named Sam Jackson, who I work with in the Sheriff's Department, Bikerks, other places. And asked them, what is it that's really troubling you about this? And so some of the things are, again, the law has a $10 max fee on the transfer of firearms. Now, if we're trying to encourage people to go to gun shops to get a background check, we have to make sure it's done in a way that would also incentivize the gun dealer to want to do this. He can't do it for $10. And I think this is actually, I would say, a fiscally conservative suggestion that we eliminate the limitation on the fee. Let the free market decide. If gun shop A says I'll charge 15 and gun shop B says to people I'll charge 12, then let that be the way it is. I would also eliminate, there's problems with ammunition purchase background checks. Somebody that has a pistol permit has gone through an extensive background check. They have a pistol permit. They're allowed to buy handguns. There's really no need for them to have to go through a background check again when they're buying ammunition. It's also onerous on gun shops and dealers when they sell ammunition. For instance, somebody, it's squirrel season now. Somebody wants to go out and buy a simple box of 22 bullets to go squirrel hunting. To have to go to the store, fill out a form, undergo a background check, have the store go through all that for a simple box of 22s, it is onerous. It's burdensome. There's no reason why we can't come up with a system similar to a hunting licenses. Or perhaps once a year, once every 3 years, a citizen could go in, go to that gun shop, go to that dealer and say, run a NICS check, the background check, and get a coupon that says, yep, this has been done, just like a hunting license. And the next time he goes to purchase ammunition, he could show that. So those are two. Another one is, I know that there's a lot of concern on the part of pistol permit holders. We're going to go to a renewal system, which I don't think is burdensome. And the state of Utah, which no one can consider as a liberal state, they have pistol permits. I have a Utah pistol permit. Many gun owners have Utah pistol permits in New York State. They have a 5-year renewal. If a 5-year renewal is good enough for Utah, I think it's good enough for us. But what I would do there is I would add a provision in the SAFE Act to make it a shall renew. I would put in a shall renew provision. What that would mean is that unless a court can show that there's a reason this person shouldn't have their renewal, for instance, they've been convicted of a domestic violence, an act of domestic violence, and maybe some other crime, that that pistol permit would be renewed. And maybe there, as we set a fee, we can set a fee there. There's some questions people don't know. Part of the problem with the resistance to the SAFE Act is unanswered questions. You know, will my permit be renewed? Will it be renewed for some frivolous reason? How much is it going to cost me? You know, if we came up with a reasonable, either a fee or no fee, but just to let people know and answer that question, and we assured people that the law-abiding citizen that has a handgun, that, you know what, unless you get arrested, unless you're convicted of a crime, your permit will be renewed. You don't have to worry about, I don't buy the confiscation thing, but you don't have to worry about that. That won't be some backdoor method to confiscate firearms.
So those are some areas that you're open to being, to change, to reform, that gun shops, that gun owners have told you they'd like to see change. Here's a big one, though, that I don't think you're willing to change on, but I'll ask you. We have had people call this program. We've had conversations on this program about so-called assault rifles. And the common complaint I hear is that it is easy to circumvent the SAFE Act. That if you own a so-called assault rifle, that you had to register it by April this year, that most people, first of all, just ignored that and didn't. We don't know the answer because we don't have the numbers. But for those who did want to comply, I have been told many times by gun owners that it is a simple modification, a tweaking of a piece of plastic. It does not change the functionality of the weapon, and therefore it becomes compliant, even though it's essentially the same firearm. Do you agree or disagree with that?
I disagree with that. And I disagree with that because, again, I have extensive experience in this field. And I could say this. That really is like the straw dog argument, where you take each feature apart and you try to say, well, if I change this one little thing, I change that little thing, I can circumvent the law. First of all, if you're changing it, you're not circumventing the law. The fact of the matter is that some of these New York compliant, quote unquote, assault rifles, they're not circumventing the law. They are compliant. That's a big difference.
But if the functionality hasn't changed on the firearm, yep. What's the point?
Well, actually, the functionality has changed, and that is exactly the point. I go so far back, I was asked just the other day, what's your definition of an assault rifle? Because, the military has one definition, the police have one definition, citizens have one definition, the NRA has one definition. So the first thing we need to do is in discussing any issue, is decide on some kind of common terminology. So I will go back to the man who designed really the first commercially made and the most successful assault rifle in the world, Mikhail Kalashnikov. Now, and people are familiar with the AK-47.
Sure.
It's the automatic Kalashnikov. It was made in 1947 by the then Soviet Union. And it is the most popular firearm in the world. So we look at that and we decide, like, why did he put these features on here? First of all, this man designed this weapon to be mass manufactured cheaply in factories in third world countries. He's not going to add anything onto that weapon that doesn't add to its effectiveness, its efficiency, or its efficacy. Those are the three standards we really deal with when we deal with lethality. One of the issues, so we look at what he decided to do, and he added every one of those features, and I don't want to spend a lot of time on that. And I would be happy to, again, if you want to have me back, because I think we have a lot of other issues to talk about, or if there's another group that I would be happy to talk about this, I refer to people why he put each and every one of those features on that weapon. Though very often what we hear from the NRA and that is that it makes no difference. It certainly makes a difference. And what they tend to concentrate on is what we call ballistic effectiveness. So that if I fire a .223 Remington round from an assault rifle, that it has the same effectiveness as a .223 fired from a weapon I own, which is a single-shot .223 rifle that can be used for varmint hunting. Those two rounds are equally effective ballistically. The difference is, for lethality, you also need to add in efficiency and efficacy. Efficiency, my single-shot rifle that I fire one round, then run another round into, and then another round into, is not as efficient as an assault rifle. I certainly wouldn't want to arm our military with single-shot rifles. None of us would. So we understand that these features do make a difference. And then there's efficacy. Is this weapon doing what it was designed to do? My .223 Remington is designed to put one hole in another at 100 yards. You know, very precise bullseye shooting, and it's very good at that. I wouldn't issue that to the military. However, an assault rifle is very good at killing a large number of people in the shortest time possible. If I could, today's New York Times, there was an article just came out, and FBI confirms a sharp rise in the mass shooting since the year 2000, when assault rifle sales really went up. One of the important findings in this article, this study that the FBI did, is the short time, the time, the mass shootings, that the number of victims has gone up in shorter periods of time. Why? The use of assault rifles in these mass shootings.
My guest for the hour is Gary Putup, 30 years in law enforcement and now running as a Democrat for the State Assembly in the 134th District. His opponent is Peter Lawrence, also retired member of law enforcement, and we're hoping to have Peter on the program before the election. We will absolutely offer equal time, and we're certainly happy to do that here on Connections. We're talking about, well, we started on the SAFE Act and these issues, but we're going to be branching out. But if you want to join the conversation on any of these matters, it's 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255. Yes, the FBI confirming more mass shootings since 2000. A lot of the people who oppose the SAFE Act will tell you that, as awful as a mass shooting is, number one, the vast majority of gun deaths in this country are with what you would call single shot or not assault rifles. And number two, that we've heard from people who are shooters on this program who own what you would call assault rifles, and they say they are in hunting season now. They're hunting squirrels, rabbits. Those are fast animals, and they need high-powered weapons. You started laughing.
Yeah. You know what? The difference between there's a huge difference between want and need. I've been hunting since I was 18 years old, all right? And it's interesting. I actually, my wife and I lived in Idaho for a short time. Now, there's real hunting out there. And when you go to talk to a guide up in the Rocky Mountains about taking a gun hunting, you don't see anybody with assault rifles. You don't see, you know, the idea that you need an assault rifle to hunt squirrels is just bizarre. In fact, most serious hunters wouldn't even use an assault rifle. You know, it's
okay.
It's really a baseless. It's a meritless argument.
That's a separate question. Yeah. Then you hear them say, mass shootings are awful. But two things about that: they say it's a small portion, and most gun deaths are not with assault rifles. And they say even if you banned assault rifles, as the SAFE Act or other legislation can do, the criminals will get those weapons anyway. Yes or no?
No. No, for two reasons. One, they're correct if they say, if you want to look at the statistics, you know, as Mark Twain said, right? You know, statistics lie, but, you know, it's or statistics tell the truth, but it's statisticians that lie. We're accounting for over 466 deaths a year from mass shootings. We saw what this community went through with the death of one police officer 2 weeks ago. The idea that there's 466 families out of there, 466 communities out there that have gone through the same pain and the same suffering. You know, if it eliminates that, it's worth getting rid of that portion. The other idea that criminals will just continue to get these guns is also a meritless argument. It's meritless because this is not an unknown. These military-style weapons have been eliminated in other countries with similar cultures to ours, and they've made vast differences. Let me point out one thing here, even in New York. In New York, the SAFE Act has been around for about 2 years. One, I don't see anybody who has been oppressed by the SAFE Act. Let's be honest. They may have some perception that they're oppressed. Nobody's gun has been taken away unlawfully. there hasn't been any mass confiscation. In addition to that, New York now ranks fourth lowest in gun deaths in the entire nation, behind such states as Hawaii and Rhode Island. That's not a coincidence. That's not a correlation. That's a cause. There have been going on 100 mass shootings at schools since passage of the SAFE Act, not one in New York State. So the idea that somehow by banning the purchase of assault rifles doesn't make a difference, it does make a difference.
All right, one other point before we get to the phones, and Jim Hilton and others, we're going to be getting to you in just a moment. Another argument that callers have made to this program who opposed the SAFE Act, Gary. One caller said, I need guns to protect my family. And in his words, assault rifles are easier for women to handle in a dangerous situation, and that he wanted his wife to be able to handle something, if the chips are down, that isn't more complex, burdensome, heavy, etc.
You know, I almost have to laugh at that. I mean, I don't understand if this is somebody that just doesn't understand the firearms, the number of firearms that are available, the different calibers, or he's just trying to say something he's been told, or to mislead us.
Is it sexist to say that women can't handle guns outside of assault rifles?
I'm going to guess that, yeah, it is. And I'll tell you what, I work with a lot of female police officers. It's almost an insult to our female police officers and troopers to indicate, you know, who routinely use, you know, 40 caliber, 45 caliber handguns and 12 gauge shotguns. It's a matter of training, one. Two, an assault rifle is a very poor weapon to use, especially in a home for self-defense. I mean, again, we can get into all the technical arguments. Let's put it this way. There's a reason why police officers, when they do a building search, use a 12-gauge shotgun and not an assault rifle. And there's lower gauges that are certainly easier to handle than an assault rifle. And nobody, particularly me, wants to take away a person's right to self-defense. And I've asked this question to the people that have brought it up before. Are you seriously telling me that you can't defend your home with a 45 1911 and a Remington 870, even in 20 or 16 gauge? Then you know what? You've got bigger problems than an assault rifle is going to handle.
Let's get to the phones. This is Jim in Hilton. Jim, you're on with Gary Putup. Thanks for calling.
Hey, Evan, how's it going?
Good.
Long time listener, first time caller.
Thanks, Jim.
I have a question for Mr. Putup about the SAFE Act. It was passed a couple years ago, quickly and in the middle of the night. I want to know if he would have voted for it under those circumstances, and would he do so again?
Well, let's start with this. It was not passed in the middle of the night. That is something that's been going around. We see that in a lot of publications, but I invite anybody to take a look at the record, to talk to assemblymen that were in the assembly at the time it was passed. And it also points out to people need to have an understanding on how the assembly and the Senate work. The bill was proposed in front of the Senate. There were three readings. The Senate passed it in the night. That is correct. Most bills get passed in the night. And there's a reason for that, because during the day, there's a lot of negotiating. There's a lot of other state business that needs to be done. And many votes, whether it's in our assembly and Senate or it's in the national. All you have to do is watch C-SPAN and see how many votes are taken. Read the newspaper, see how many votes are taken in Congress, in the Senate and the House of Representatives, in the evening and in the night. Here's the second problem with that, is after the Senate was the first to pass it, then it went to the Assembly, not the other way around. The Assembly debated it all day long, during the day. Then, after that, it went to the governor. Now, we can have a debate and we can have a discussion about how it was passed. And I agree with that. Maybe, perhaps, there should have been
public hearings?
More time.
How about public hearings? Should there have been
but
public hearings?
I can tell you this. What's done is done in regards to that. Two, the idea that it was passed in the middle of the night is simply inaccurate. All one has to do is look at the record.
Okay, but outside of the middle of the night, I think the question is, was it passed too hastily without public input, Gary?
Right. Thanks, Evan.
Yeah, thanks for the call, Jim.
And that I would agree, because I think some of the things that I'm talking about, like the $10.
The parts that you would
reform. The caller and I think we agree. And because some of these things could have been worked out, I think firearm dealers should have been brought into the process. There's no question about that. And in fact, actually, one of the positions I've taken in this campaign is my openness, willing to debate, willing to talk to anybody. And I have a history of that in my personal and professional life. I think that's one of the things I did here. When this act was passed, when I started to run, again, the first thing I did is I went to various gun shops, I went to various dealers, and I asked them straight, what is it about the Safe Act that really bothers you? What is it that should be different? Yeah, the dealers should have had a place at the table. No question about that.
This is Peter from Rochester. Go ahead, Peter.
Good afternoon. Look, physics still requires a gun to be triggered before it's fired. The focus is unfortunately on the gun and not the deeper-seated problems that we're dealing with. These are symptoms of the problems. Look at the numbers. The last numbers I looked at about a year or so ago when the act was passed, of the 32,000-plus gun deaths that occurred in this country, more than 19,000 were suicides. Now, when you consider that 22 of those suicides a day are former service members, one has to ask, why is it that we still do not have a universal, comprehensive healthcare system in this country that includes mental health services? You get into deeper the next biggest group, you look at the violent crime rates. Where are violent crimes committed? They're committed in large cities. These are FBI numbers, large cities with populations of 250,000 or greater. And it's not only that we can identify that they are resulting that they're occurring in large cities, but we could even pinpoint the specific neighborhoods. What is prevalent in these neighborhoods? Poverty, lack of health care, and lack of education. No jobs. The other, you're also going to get into the root causes of some of the other issues with suicides and violent crimes within families. These are stressed families because of economic situations. You have people.
Hey, Peter, can I address your concerns?
Yeah, go ahead, Gary.
Sure, go ahead.
Peter, you know what? I am so glad you called. I am. You know, you and I have talked on the radio before, and I am so glad you called, because this is one of the things I wanted to get around to. Look, the SAFE Act is important for some folks, and dealing with gun control is important, but we need to take a holistic approach to what our problems are in society. I am, by no means am I saying that if we continue the ban on the sale of assault rifles, and it's not a ban on assault rifles, it's a ban on the future sale of assault rifles.
Right.
If we keep up with background checks, I am not naive. I was a cop for 30 years. There will still be problems. But we have bigger problems to deal with, including the survival of the middle class, the loss of opportunities, tax fairness, deficit spending and education reform, the fair treatment of all people regardless of gender, color, or creed, and getting sustainable jobs with meaningful pay and benefits to all of our citizens, rather than worrying about whether we have the proper gun to stage a successful revolution. One of the things, and again, Peter, I'm glad you called, because I have two proposals that I would like to get out on the air today. One is my support of the New York Health Act. A lot of people are not aware of this, but we have proposed in the Assembly is a bill that would give us something similar to, not the same as, because it wouldn't involve mandates and some other things, but it would involve basically a single-payer universal health plan for New York State, for our people.
Similar to what Vermont is doing? Okay.
And I think this is where you're going to see this. If other states don't want to get on board with the Affordable Care Act, you know, we can't force those other states to do that. But we can do in New York and do that and take care of our people. And, you know, Evan, one of the reasons I'm running is to help create a New York that we can be grateful to live in. I want to have a New York that can serve as an example to the rest of the nation that what can be done in a progressive state and not a regressive state. And if I may,
go ahead.
Because I want to look at the example, and I always think of the example of our stand on marriage fairness. There were a lot of states, again, like Vermont and some other smaller states, that when it came to the issue of marriage fairness, there was some headway making, some headway was made. When New York State went ahead with marriage fairness, marriage equality for all, you just saw the dominoes start to fall. Why? Because New York is looked at in this nation as a leader. And when people saw that in New York the sky didn't fall, that actually families were made stronger, that it was better for our economy, that it made the quality of life in New York better, you just saw state after state starting until we get to the point where just 2 years later, this nation is sitting back now saying, well, why didn't, you know, what was the big dust up about to begin with? And I think we can do that. And again, these holistic approaches, you know, to issue like what Peter's talking about. Yeah, we need a law, or we need government action making mental health on par with physical, you know, physical ailments.
All right, real briefly on single payer. Are you concerned about how the state would pay for that?
Actually, if you look at the plan, we're concerned about it. But if you get a chance to read the plan, basically what it would be doing is using all the monies we're getting from the federal government and state anyway, and instead of like paying them out separately, it would actually streamline bureaucracy because it would go into a single fund. So rather than like, okay, so we have Medicare, we have Medicaid, every county has these unfunded mandates and everybody's got to pay out. Not only is that a bureaucratic mess, but it's also onerous and burdensome on the counties. And, you know, very often we hear, especially from the other party, that we have to, you know, defund mandates. We have to get rid of mandates. Well, but I mean, we never hear anything particular about exactly how are we going to do this. This is one way that we can do this. We combine these resources into a common pool. That's how insurance companies work. We know that collectively that we can do better than when we try to do this individually.
Got a lot of ground to cover here. I'm going to take one more quick call. If you're waiting on the line, no matter what subject you want to talk about, we will get to you. I'm going to take one more call on the Safe Act. This is Ron from East Rochester. Go ahead, Ron.
Good morning. I just have a couple of quick comments. First of all, it's very, very, very refreshing to hear someone with an adult point of view and not pandering to the fear-mongering that's been going around about this issue. And after the call's over, after off the air, I'd like to get your guest's name again so that I can support him in his upcoming bid. Two comments quickly that I have is I heard Bob Costas last night making one of the most adult and educated statements that I've heard regarding professional athletes and the abuse of their spouses and the access that they have to multiple weapons. I would like your guest to address also, if he may. That was just Costas's comment was just very refreshing to hear. But Claire McCaskill also has an issue that I'm very curious about, and I'm wondering if your guest would care to comment on that. And that is giving ex-military equipment to police agencies around the country, and in particular, she's mentioned a couple of cases where there have been very, very rural police agencies with perhaps one or two members that are getting all of these mechanical automatic weapons and things that the military is dumping on them. So, yeah, if I could get your guest's name off the air, I'd love to hear his comments after I've gone, and that's my comment.
Ron, thanks for the call. The guest, by the way, is Gary Putup. He's a retired member of the law enforcement community, spent 30 years in multiple departments. He's running for the 134th District Assembly seat, which is Greece, Parma,
and Ogden.
We can also tell you that Gary is running against another member from the law enforcement community. That's Peter Lawrence, who was a state trooper and U.S. Marshal. We're hoping to have Peter on this program as well before Election Day in the interest of equal time, so we've made that offer as well. Gary, he's talking about the militarization of police, or the so-called militarization, especially in smaller departments. Thoughts on that?
Well, Evan, if I could go back to his first point,
just to make sure
that we get that covered. One of my top priorities in this race has been women's issues and getting the Women's Equality Act passed in New York. After I left law enforcement, you know, I worked for a human rights organization and one that guards the Constitution, the New York Civil Liberties Union. And I became impassioned about women's issues. I've done work and I've done volunteer work on women's issues. And I think that women are some of the most neglected members of our society. They are not valued. They're not looked upon as equal members, and they need to be. Women in this state still make less than men doing the same jobs unless they're unionized. Women who are the victims of domestic violence still face discrimination in housing and in employment. Right now, in our situation is that a woman who is the victim of domestic violence is 5 times more likely to be murdered if her abuser is in possession of a firearm. This is, again, one of the provisions of the SAFE Act. I cannot see scrapping and then trying to rebuild. Right now, the SAFE Act allows the police, when a man has abused a woman, to take his weapons. Now, people can call a confiscation if they want, but frankly, I did it too long to think that if a man punches a woman, as Ray Rice did, what he would have done if he had a gun in his hand. That, to me, a man like that shouldn't be walking around with guns. So, you know, I'm glad he brought that up. And that's a prime example is why we don't want to scrap something. I don't want there to be a window of opportunity where abusers can get a hold of guns and then abuse a woman. In regards to the militarization of the police.
Is that even a state issue?
Well, yes, it is.
Okay.
There's a couple of things. Actually, if I could put in a quick plug. For the Rochester Public Library, the Friends of the Rochester Public Library does a program called Book Sandwiched In. And you'd have to go to their website, but very soon they're going to be doing a book review of The Rise of the Warrior Cop by a man named Rako. It was a very good study.
Radley Balco.
Yep, thank you very much.
Yeah.
And it will be at the Kate Gleason Auditorium. You could check their website. And the presentation is going to be given by the Honorable James Malley, who is a former police officer. He's a professor at MCC. And in addition to that, he's one of our local magistrates, man with a lot of experience. There is some concern about that. I have a concern about it. You know, having been in law enforcement as long as I was, and we see this issue, and it's not just in the city of Rochester, it's everywhere across the United States. Is we have to keep in mind that the police are part of the community. They're not at war with the community. Part of the issue is when you start giving people this kind of equipment is how it's going to be used. The public doesn't even know that a lot of this equipment has been given out. I just recently learned almost every SUNY campus has an armored vehicle, and I'm trying to figure out why. That our SUNY campuses have a police force, but they also have automatic weapons and armored personnel carriers. And maybe we can have a discussion about the need for that, but I think having done that and not knowing about it is troublesome. I understand the Ferguson chief made an apology. I didn't get a chance to read it today. It was in this morning's news. I'll tell you, I was shocked to see the response. You know, whatever happened in Ferguson, and we won't know for a while, and let that play out. I'm going to give the officer the benefit of the doubt, as he's legally entitled to, and having been a law enforcement officer, things aren't always as they seem. However, when I saw, I just cringed when I saw the police respond with automatic weapons to a crowd. And my first thought is, exactly what are you going to do with an assault rifle with a crowd of a couple of hundred people? My second thought is what really disturbed me is this was a crowd of African Americans, and the police responded with dogs, and I know that wouldn't happen here. I pray that it wouldn't happen here, and I think what the issue there was, it's a communication issue. A lot of our police weren't around in the 1960s; they weren't around when these things happened. But this is something that still survives in the Black community. That we had a situation here where that has a particular symbolism, and I'm not blaming the police, but I'm saying that we need to be aware as police officers and as part of the community is how we respond to these instances, and the use of dogs on an African American crowd it was really troubling.
All right, I am way overdue for a break, and we've got a ton of phone calls lined up. If you're waiting, we've got about 12 more minutes left with Gary Putup. He is running for the Assembly. His opponent, Peter Lawrence, we hope to have on this program soon. We're going to hit parole, a little more on health care, minimum wage, and more after this short break. Coming up in our second hour, it's been 45 years since Led Zeppelin arrived in the United States. The critics predicted they wouldn't last. How wrong they were. We'll preview a big weekend event and we'll sift through the history with U of R Professor John Kovach. Then we'll get an update on pediatric cancer in the Western New York community, the rates and the treatment. All of that coming up next hour on Connections.
Rivers are often borders. Take the Rio Grande between Texas and Mexico.
I lived one street away from the river. The river was just more like a highway that you had to cross to get to where you needed to be.
But what happens when the river moves? Today, how people's lives are changed by natural and unnatural borders. That's later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
That's All Things Considered this afternoon at 4 on your public radio station.
I'm Evan Dawson. Welcome back to Connections. Last question from the host this hour, and then we turn it all over to the phones.
Good.
Yesterday on this program, State Senator Joe Robach was here. He's talking about parole. His concern is that too many violent offenders don't serve long enough sentences right now or don't serve out their full sentence and are let out before either they're ready or before they should be. Do you agree?
You know, this is a really complex issue.
I know it is.
No, not necessarily, but yes. I mean, look it. So we have some serious, serious issues, not only in this state, but in this nation. We have the highest recidivism rate in the world. We also have the highest rate of incarceration for the longest periods of time. And every time something bad happens, what do we hear? Well, we got to increase penalties. Let me tell you something. As somebody that dealt with this for 30 years, and I believe you had a situation, you had some people on just in the last couple of weeks talking about domestic violence. When a person commits those acts, the length of the sentence means very little to them. These are generally acts of passion or desperation. The parole board does a good job. It's very expensive to keep people in prison. Our prisons are overpopulated. And we put these people in an impossible situation. But as Peter, you know, said before, we really need to have a serious conversation about how we address crime in our communities. We need to take a holistic approach. When people lose hope, they commit crimes. If there's no chance that when they get out of prison that they have a job or that they have a future, their family's been taken away from them because they've been in prison for years, and there's no support systems, then I don't understand why anyone would be surprised what happened here in Rochester.
All right, so a couple quick yes-nos then. The governor proposed tuition for inmates in prison. He figured it would cost $3,000 to $5,000 a year per inmate if they were on good behavior. He estimates $60,000 a year for incarceration. Do you support that?
Yes.
And banning the box is a big issue in Rochester and across the country. Do you support making it illegal to ask on the first job application, whether right off the top, whether someone is convicted of a crime?
Yes, and I would like to make a comment on that also.
Go ahead.
Having been in law enforcement and having been a rights advocate, this is an issue I think that we need to deal with. You know, most crimes are being committed by young men who are in dysfunctional situations. Now, I don't know about you, Evan, but when I was 16, 17, 18, 19, and 20, I made a whole lot of bad decisions.
I made none, but go ahead.
I can see that you're here at WXXI,
Yeah.
But I made a whole lot of bad decisions. And some, quite frankly, if I was in a different situation, would have changed my life dramatically.
Sure.
So why is it that when in a nation that actually prides itself on being a nation built on Judeo-Christian ethic of forgiveness, say to a young man that once you've committed a crime and done time, you will be ostracized for the rest of your life. That even if 20 years later, you have a family, that you have responsibilities, pay your taxes, and are a good citizen, that you can't participate in democracy. if we want to bring people back to the table, we have to set a place at the table for them.
All right, let's move quickly here, and this is, we're going to go right down the line here. Greg, Spencerport, go ahead.
Thanks, Evan, for giving me the opportunity to speak on your show.
Sure.
Great. So my question pertains to minimum wage. So there are talks around the country right now about increasing minimum wage, and I just wanted to ask Gary, what is his position on this particular issue for farm and fast food workers?
Thanks, Greg. Go ahead, Gary.
Well, again, thanks for the question. I'm glad to address this issue. I think Franklin Delano Roosevelt got it right when, during the Great Depression, he said, you know, businesses are responsible to pay living wages. I not only favor the raising of minimum wage, I think what we have to work towards is living wages.
What should the minimum wage be now or in the near future?
Well, at least I know that there's a 10-10 proposal. The problem with the 10-10 proposal is $10.10 an hour gets you one thing in Long Island. It gets you another thing in Monroe County, and it gets you something else in Steuben County or
so
the North Country.
So sort of regionally, you have flexibility on minimum wage based on where you live?
Absolutely.
Would you attach it to the rate of inflation?
Yes.
Okay. So at least 10-10 is what you're saying?
Yes.
Maybe 15?
Maybe. And see, well, that would depend, again, in the area, okay, whatever. And I understand that are all the arguments that, well, we would have counties competing against each other. Well, one, we could do regions, too. This is an issue also of taxpayer fairness for property owners and the everyday man. I mean, we have large corporations that are paying below a living wage. We have people that are going to work and still need to be on public assistance. That's not right.
All right. Candace, Rochester. Go ahead, Candace. Make it quick here. We're going to try to keep going.
I wanted to applaud Gary on his courageous stance on the SAFE Act, and I know it's a difficult one in this area. Also, I wanted to just make briefly a comment on the fact that although it's very popular to have a gun in your home to guard against home intruders, for every home intruder who's shot, there are 4 suicides of teenagers who happen to be in the house and have access to a weapon, and something like 8 accidental deaths of someone who's coming home unexpectedly. So I know that in this area, it's kind of a killer issue. There are many people who, for whatever reason, are opposed to the SAFE Act. And I applaud Gary for kind of exploding some of the myths around that act and around gun control.
Candace, thanks for the call. Anything to disagree with there, Gary?
Not at all. And I'd just like to point out, Candace is absolutely correct. Actually, one of the statistics with the victims of domestic violence is if a woman owns a gun, she's 11 times more likely to be murdered because her abuser will get access to that gun and then end up using it on her. Thanks.
All right, John, Rochester. Go ahead, John.
Hey, Gary, I'm in your district, and our neighbors have this argument, and we actually agree on this one, the death penalty, and that scumbag Thomas Johnson killed Daryl Pearson. The death penalty should be invoked, if the opinion of our neighborhood is, and we got these left-wing liberal judges like Jonathan Lippman down, he's the head of the Court of Chief Judge of the Court of Appeals, with the sympathetic ears to these scumbags like Thomas Johnson. What's your opinion on the death penalty? Should Thomas Johnson, in a perfect world, be killed like he should be?
Should he be executed?
But he won't be because of the laws of this state.
Thank you, John. Go ahead, Gary.
You know, sorry, John, but we have to disagree on this one. I think it's one thing when somebody terrible murders somebody else. I don't think the state should engage in that act. I do believe in life without parole. This man should be put, well, let's put it this way. As hard as this is and all the evidence is there, he hasn't been found guilty of anything. But we're pretty confident he will be. And this is a case of life without parole.
Last caller is Ben in Pittsford. And Ben, you got about 30 seconds. Go.
All right, I wanted to touch base on what you just said there. I mean, we had William Spengler back in Webster on Christmas Eve use a weapon to kill people, and you're saying that people who got out of jail should be rehabilitated and not receive death penalty, and they shouldn't have to put down an application. Well, why are we blaming the gun and creating the SAFE Act, which targets law-abiding citizens, when here we have a perfect case of a guy who murdered his grandmother with a hammer? We let him out of jail to kill more people.
Thank you, Ben.
All right, to be clear, I'm not blaming the gun. Two, Spengler should have never, we agree. Spengler should have never been let out of jail. He committed a heinous act. He should have remained in prison.
That was a mistake. But Ben is also saying the SAFE Act targets law-abiding citizens and turns them into criminals. You disagree?
Yes. You know, we have this. There is one, actually, there's one provision that deals with pre-owned high-capacity magazines. That's another thing that I would actually amend and take out of the law, because that does that. Other than that, it doesn't.
And in January, a judge ruled out the seven-round limit, thought it was arbitrary. You agree with that judge's ruling?
Agreed.
Okay. So we've covered a lot of ground with Gary Putup. Want to thank Gary for his time today. Gary, thank you for coming
Thanks,
in.
Thanks, Evan.
And if we couldn't get to your calls or comments, we were loaded up today. I know a lot of people wanted to talk about these issues and more. Gary's running for the 134th Assembly District seat as a Democrat. His opponent, Republican Peter Lawrence, who is also a retired member of the law enforcement community. Peter Lawrence has an open invitation to come on this program between now and Election Day, and I hope to see him sooner than later so you can have a chance to meet him, hear his views and his take on these many issues as we head toward the November elections. Short break and more with you next on Member Supported Public Radio.